Yes, it is a creepy and curious world out there. And this morning we head into, I guess, the curious end of the spectrum and find out about how we use our senses. On a Tuesday morning on ABC New England Northwest, if you're joining us from around the region, we have this rather intriguing little chat called Creepy But Curious. So I think we're going to be the curious end of the spectrum. I'm not too sure. Why are handshakes so special? What sort of information do you get from a humble handshake beyond a simple greeting? What part does eye contact play? Temperature of the hand? If it's a little bit clammy, what does that say about you? And how does our brain filter through all that information? Dr. Paul McDonald is a scientist from the University of New England in Armidale. Good morning, Paul.
Morning, Kel. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. How are you travelling post-Easter? Did you indulge?
No, I was very good. I'm just, as a Geelong fan, not too impressed with the football yesterday. So
well, commiserations.
Probably gloss over that.
I won't mention that the Bunnies did win in the NRL. A fairly controversial game, but I'm taking it and I'm running. Well, let's talk about handshakes and some brain filtering that helps, that goes along alongside this. So why are our senses an important part of our behaviour?
Yeah, well, we need to... handshakes are a good example, I think, because they're an interesting... something that we tend to take for granted. It's something that's fairly simple, fairly quick. But some recent research, which I'll get to in a moment, has really come out and identified quite a few interesting things that are going on in the background. So it gets to the concept of brain filtering, if you like, in terms of how we interact with our environment. Now, there's lots going on, and when we think of the typical senses of sight and hearing and so forth, our brain's taking in lots of information, but there's a lot of filtering, if you like, that going on that weeds out the things that aren't important and allows us to really focus in on the conscious things that are. And one of the best ways to illustrate how much of that is going on, I think, is a concept called habituation. I think we've probably touched on it a little bit before, but for those that aren't familiar with it, it's where, in effect, the brain's filtering out anything that's not particularly relevant. So classic examples are if you're sitting in a room and there's a little bit of a speaker hum, for example, or with sight, the best one is probably our nose. Now, no matter which way you look, at all times your nose is visible to your eyes, so you should actually be seeing your nose in the bottom of your vision. But most of the time our brain filters it out, so you're probably seeing your nose now because we're talking about it, but up until that point it's not a relevant stimuli, so your brain doesn't actually focus in on it. So things like that are happening all the time. So there's lots of information coming in, and the brain, if you like, is picking out the relevant bits that are important for the animal. So handshakes are a recent example that have come out. There's lots going on behind the scenes, if you like.
Okay, so they're not just a simple way to greet people. What's going on with handshakes?
Well, there's an awful lot, and I did a bit of Googling on this last week, just having a look, and there is a very large number of websites devoted to the handshake. So clearly there's lots of people thinking about it. But look, they are a way to greet people, as you mentioned, and there's lots of different ways around different cultures. So a similar type greeting is the kiss on the cheek that you see through some parts of Europe, for example. All of them have these really interesting side effects going on. So the actual origins are a little bit difficult to pin down, but it looks like somewhere around the 5th century BC, the handshake and the sort of kiss-on-the-cheek type greetings evolved pretty much as a way of showing that people were open and ready to accept a friendly interaction rather than an aggressive one. So often it's the weapon hand, so the right handshake is the hand that most people carry a knife in, for example, or a sword or whatever back in the day. Some of the movements, like scouts, for example, it's the left hand, and that's from the African origin, so that was the shield hand, so symbolising that they're open to the interaction and so forth. Those little differences in terms of what a actual greeting is used, whether it's a kiss or a handshake, aren't really that important. What is important is it enables people to get close, engage the intent and also the sincerity of the other person during that interaction.
And that's fascinating because often I guess we're taught to look at someone. I mean, you do, you're growing, when you're a child, people tell you as you grow up, you judge someone by their handshake. Do they have a firm group? Is it weak? And what does it say about them? So what sort of information do we take away from a handshake?
Well, there's an awful lot. There's 12 main ones that seem to be popping up around the place. It's a great example of how much is going on and what your brain's able to filter through. But some of the ones that keep popping up and different levels of support from the research, but certainly anecdotally all of these come out as being important. You touched on strength, whether it's a weak handshake or overly strong can influence a person's response. Temperature is an important one, whether the cold hand or hot hand, and related to that is also moisture. So people want a dry handshake in effect, and the moist, sweaty hand is not generally appreciated, regardless of the culture. Interesting one to me was the fullness of the grip. So whether some people you might have encountered sort of almost just a grip with the fingers and not involving the palm and so forth. So there's a whole trade-off about how much of the actual hand is in contact. And then there's a whole world of complexity in terms of the duration of it, so how long or short it is, whether the actual up and down movements are fast or slow, or how intricate they are, even whether it's just a simple movement or something more complex. And of course, eye contact. Now, eye contact's a really important one in terms of some of the things we're talking about in terms of conveying sincerity and honesty in the actual signal and intent in the interaction. But all of these things interact, and your brain actually processes all of these without you consciously thinking about them in most cases. And ultimately what happens is there's actually a physiological change that goes on in the person's body during and after a handshake event. And so-called trust molecules being released by the process, and that's a hormone called oxytocin. So you can actually measure the effect of a handshake via the release of that hormone, and it's not exactly clear what that hormone does in a lot of different contexts, but one of the analogies that have been used for it is it's your happy thoughts hormone. So the more of that hormone that's released, the more positive the interaction for the person. And in subsequent experiments, they're actually more likely to cooperate and even lend money to people that release this oxytocin. So all of those, clearly there's lots of people nervous about handshakes based on the number of those websites and so on, but it does seem like it's that important. So probably not going to allay your fears there, but it's certainly influenced subsequent behaviour. And these really quick decisions that happen, just in a couple of minutes of the handshake, or sort of 10 seconds, I guess we're talking from go to woe, but they can influence how a person is perceived for a very long time thereafter. So they're really quite important.
Wow. Dr. Paul McDonald with us on ABC Local Radio, and he's talking to us about the world of, senses and handshake. I mean, you said eye contact, Paul, the clammy palm moisture, that all sounds pretty creepy. Is there something a little bit more to worry about in a handshake?
Yes, I'm afraid there is. Some Israeli scientists have published a paper very recently and added a whole new component to it, which is, I think, at the creepy end of the perspective, continuing for me at least, anyway. But it turns out smell is also a very important one. It shouldn't be news to you, Kelly, but it's not particularly socially acceptable to run around smelling people, at least in Western culture. It tends to be frowned upon. But the argument here, or the research here, was looking at whether a handshake provides a nice window that enables people to smell each other in a socially acceptable way. So lots of things going on in transfer of a handshake, and one of the arguments has always been things like germs and so forth have been transferred. Mm. What they wanted to look at is whether smells were being transferred. So they had people shaking hands where one participant would have be wearing a glove, and then they could look at what happened, what substances were put onto that glove, and whether there was transfer of components that would facilitate a smell. Now, these are actual chemical compounds. They're called chemosignals. Lots of very important in mammals generally, but not in humans, not really thought to be that important. But they're starting to become more and more interesting as some of this research is coming out. So they did indeed confirm that with a handshake, these chemosignals or chemical compounds that are important for smell were being transferred. So the first step showed that it was possible. Then where it got a little bit creepy is they were filming 280 individuals that were either shaking hands or not. And what they're actually doing is looking at the number of times those individuals smelt their right hand. So just, you know, subtly lifting the hand to the nose and having a wee smear. Wee sniff, rather. And it turns out that this is a fully balanced experiment. So we've got some shaking hands and some not, and looking before and after. And it was the individuals that did shake hands actually did smell their hands more after that handshake. So and it did fall out as a significant effect. So it turns out that probably subconsciously, it's presumably not an active thought, but people are indeed smelling their hand more often after a handshake. So lots more to go on this, and really just at the infancy of whether how much information is actually taken in from that smell. But it does look like we are actually smelling each other post-handshake, and potentially a whole raft of information might be taken on board from that.
Do you have any recollections of doing that, Paul?
I'm certain that I wouldn't do that, Kelly, because that would just be socially outrageous, so I'm sure I'm not smelling my hand. But it always is a bit nerve-wracking when you know, particularly if you've not met someone before, you know, important context, you know, job interviews and things like that. It is a bit of a minefield. So, yeah, perhaps one needs to just make sure the right chemicals are transferred. But unfortunately, we can't tell you what they are at this point.
And just, do you think, like, in that situation, does someone, when you shake hands, is someone always the dominating sort of force, or is it, can it be on equal terms, or is it almost a competition sometimes?
Sometimes I think it can be a competition, and you know, particularly you know, on the sporting field and things like that, there's a whole range of things going on, and a lot of subtle psychology as well. So if you know, shaking hands with the boss, you, for example, you'd want to convey competence, but also a submission role as well. So, you know, all of these things come into it. So, it is really interesting how much is going on here, and it's a real example where very simple cultural interaction, very quick, but lots of things happening in the background, and lots of information being both submitted and also taken on board by the other party.
All right, Paul McDonald with us from the University of New England in Armidale, and creepy but curious this morning. You might have just been creeped out and you might be smelling your hand right now if no one's watching. I don't know. So that's all strange things that we're up to or that our brain's probably doing without us even knowing about, Paul. What about, do you have any other examples of where animals are sort of gathering information from their environment in rather unusual ways?
Yeah, well, I thought we'd talk about a couple of other different species where things are being, as you say, taken on board in very strange ways. And one of the ones that's always fascinated me is there are quite a number of frog species around the world that don't actually have any ears. Now, when you think about frogs, the little bags of meat sitting on the old lily pad, to attract other frogs and potential you know, mating partners, they croak, and various combinations of that call, but pretty much all species vocalise to attract others. Now, really interestingly, the species without ears also continue to croak, which has always been quite perplexing, because if they don't have ears, how, what's the point?
Just feel the vibrations, or I don't know.
Well, some recent research come out of some France, French researchers have looked at something called the gardener's frog on the Seychelles, which beautiful place to work if you can spring it. But what these guys were interested in is with gardener's frog, it's one of those species that doesn't have an ear. So if you think about the classic ear on, it's different across different taxa, but you've got some sort of aperture or hole in ear canal, if you like, that connects the outside world with the middle ear and then through to the inner ear, which that processes the sound wave so that it converts it to electrical information that the brain can interpret. Now, far, far more complicated than that, but in effect, you need some sort of window to the outside world so that the brain can get access to those sound waves. Now, these frogs don't have that actual connection, so they don't have that outside ear canal. So there's, it doesn't look like there was any way that they could actually listen to that sound. Now, researchers knew it wasn't coming from through the skin because frog skin actually repels 99.9% of the sound waves, so they're not absorbing it through their skin. So wondered why these guys would actually call and what they could do, whether they could even hear. So the first experiment looked at whether they reacted to sound, and it turns out they did. So they were actually listening somehow to the environment. So what they had to do is use x-rays to see how they would actually take in this information. And it turns out these guys have solved the problem of not having a an actual ear by using their mouth. So what they can do is actually open their mouth, and the amount of tissue between the upper lining of the mouth and where that inner ear is located is much reduced in these species. So the sound energy can actually get from their open mouth through the roof of their mouth and into their inner ear and subsequently brain that way. So rather than having an ear structure, they can simply just open their mouth and use that as a way to hear other acoustic information. So it turns out they might have different organs with different components, but they're still able to access that information in their environment. So I thought that was really neat that these little frogs without ears simply open their mouth. I thought that was a wonderful way of solving a particular problem.